The Transitional Services Division purpose is to contribute to the successful community living for those individuals convicted of felonies in Oregon by community supervision and by addressing the criminal risk factors both in prison and the community and in community that contribute to future criminal behavior. The risk factors that we prioritize in both settings are alcohol and drug problems, antisocial thinking, lack of educational and vocational achievement, and lack of prosocial support and activities. The division impacts over 35,000 felony offenders in the community and over 13,400 inmates in state prisons. This division includes the operation of community corrections, the Interstate Compact, religious services, victim services, the DOC volunteer program, sentence computation and offender records, and also institution programs such as work-based education and adult education, cognitive programs, and addictions treatment programs. Community corrections is 17.5% of the governor's recommended budget for the Department of Corrections. All of the other functions of the Transitional Services Division make up only 4% of the governor's recommended budget for the department, and that is the same as in the current biennium in terms of proportion. Slide 4 shows the five major organizational units of the division. And I'll talk very briefly about each of those units before we move into the budget drivers. The largest part, obviously, of Transitional Services Division, both budget-wise, is the administration of Oregon's Community Corrections Act. Oregon's had a Community Corrections Act since 1977. It was amended by Senate Bill 1145 in 1995, and at that time, county participation was made mandatory as of January 97. However, at that time, one-third of the counties had already made the choice to operate their own community corrections function, and because those tended to be the larger counties, most felony offenders in Oregon were already being supervised by county employees when the mandatory change happened in January of 97. The grants for community corrections fund a whole array of interventions, including supervision of felony offenders in the community, and also correctional programs and community-based sanctions for that group. It includes 35,000 felony offenders who are serving sentences of probation, parole, post-prison supervision, and also those who are serving prison sentences of 12 months or less that are now served at the county level. There's a great deal of attention oftentimes paid to that group. It is a new responsibility for community corrections as of 1997. However, that group is a very small proportion of the 35,000 offenders that make up the community corrections population. Right now, it's about 1,200 individuals, or about 3% of the entire population that is covered by community corrections. You heard yesterday testimony from the community corrections directors about the various types of interventions and activities that are included in Oregon's concept of community corrections. It's much more than simply supervising those offenders, although about half of the grant money goes towards supervision. Just to give you a sort of perspective of some of the other things that are included in community corrections and funded by the state grant, on any particular day, state funds support 5,527 slots for outpatient alcohol and drug treatment, 540 slots for residential alcohol and drug treatment, 2,654 slots of domestic violence treatment, 2,240 slots of sex offender treatment, 868 slots for services identified specifically as transitional services for inmates leaving prison and returning to community living. Almost 800 slots of electronic home detention, over 6,000 slots of work crew.
Ms. Martin, are those statistics in your presentation?
They are not.
Could you get those to us?
I certainly could.
Right.
Wanted you to get just a sense of all of the comprehensive interventions and activities that are part of community corrections. The decision about what particular array of community-based sanctions and community-based interventions and how much of the grant would be used for supervision and some of these other activities is a local decision. It's made ultimately by the County Board of Commissioners in consultation with the local public safety coordinating council. The coordinating council includes representation from the entire local criminal justice system. The thinking behind this and the philosophy is that that is the group most knowledgeable about what the community prioritizes and needs in terms of managing the group of offenders that are living amongst them. Next unit is our transition and release unit, which is a new unit proposed for this coming biennium. This will be the organizational home of the transition and reentry coordinators that are part of the governor's recommended budget. Offender information and sentence computation is another function in this division. That unit is responsible for ensuring that each inmate's release date is accurately calculated and kept up to date. This is certainly a priority and a duty of the Department of Corrections, but having a firm release date also helps us do good transition planning because we can plan on that continuity of intervention when the individual leaves prison. This unit also maintains all offender paper records in prison and archives all records for felony offenders in Oregon, including institution records and community corrections records. And finally, the unit provides a great deal of information to the public, since that is the single place that anyone can go to find out about any felony offender in Oregon. Next function within the division is workforce development. This is the part of our organization that delivers educational and vocational programs, cognitive behavior change programs, and addictions treatment programs. About half of the inmates who enter prison have some kind of a basic education need. They are either illiterate, not able to read up to the eighth grade level, or they need a credential, a GED. During the time that those folks are with us, about 80% of them do receive some kind of educational services. Also, 42% who enter prison without a GED leave prison with one. So we're reaching a good proportion of the folks who come to us without an educational credential. We deliver these services by contracting with Oregon's local community college system. In the area of alcohol and drug treatment, we operate four intensive residential treatment programs and have two additional treatment units planned for Deer Ridge and Madras. We also operate one day treatment Spanish language program. About three-quarters of the individuals who come to prison do have an alcohol and drug problem. 57% of them have a severe problem or addiction, and this is a group that we prioritize for treatment. We prioritize treatment in the last 6 months of an individual's stay with us because the research supports that that helps with the transition to the community and connecting these individuals with support and ongoing care when they leave. Given that we are looking at not the whole population to be in treatment at any particular time, but just that last six-month group, we estimate that we need 760 beds of residential treatment just to serve the high-risk, high-need group in that last 6 months of their stay with us. So we have an unmet need today of about 400 beds. And we're reaching about 40% of our prioritized population with the treatment capacity that we have available to us. Cognitive programs are also prioritized to treat those with the most serious kinds of antisocial thinking, and that thinking that's most closely connected to their ongoing criminal behavior. About 30% of our population are in that high-risk group, and we are reaching about 50% of those individuals in our cognitive programs.
Sorry. Could you give me some numbers to quantify that? Or if you don't have those available, could you get those?
I have capacity. I don't have completions in a year with me. Capacity in COG is 920. But you're looking for completion data.
Well, no. So we have, you said 30% were in the high-risk category that need this kind of program. 50% actually get it of that 30. So it's the 920 for 30% or the 50% of the 50%?
Chair Shields, 920 is the capacity that we are able to serve at any particular time. There are about 4,000 inmates in our population at any particular time who we would prioritize for this kind of treatment.
That makes sense to everybody? You're saying is 4,000 needed and you have capacity for 920, right?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair? I guess what I don't understand, and maybe it's back to the question about 30% in the high-risk category. I mean, it seems to be that most inmates would be in a higher-risk category. You know, where do you draw the line? How do you draw that line?
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, we do an assessment when an individual comes into prison at the intake center, and we assess them for their criminal risk factors. So we're, during that assessment, looking for what particular criminal risk factors seem most associated with that individual's propensity.
All right. So that's not those most in need of cognitive-based training programs.
Right. Okay.
All right.
Ms. Martin, can I ask you one other question? This might not be one you have an answer to, but do you have a number of the number of inmates who are who would be considered medium risk to recidivate? Or is that something you could look into and get to Mr. Wilson?
Chair Shields, yes. Our population is about half low risk, half medium high. There are more medium than high, but I don't remember the specific number off the top of my head. Religious services is also a function within the division, and this unit is responsible for either facilitating directly through our chaplains or accommodating through volunteers the full range of religious and spiritual services for all of the faith traditions of inmates who come to our system. Over a two-year period, about 70% of the male and 96% of the female population will attend some kind of faith-based service. This unit operates the Department of Corrections Volunteer Program. Over 2,000 volunteers work in the Department of Corrections, and they work in every division and every prison. These volunteers donate more than 600,000 hours of service in a biennium, which is the equivalent of about 288 full-time staff. This unit also manages...
Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The statistic that you just mentioned about how many people participate in a faith-based service, participate once or participate regularly, like every week?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, those figures are people who participate at any time, but we can sort our data any way that you might want to see it. We can also look at the data for regular participators versus occasional.
Yeah, I clarified. Having attended just once out of several years, it would probably indicate perhaps an interest, but then not, it didn't meet the need, and that would be quite different than someone who's attending every week or at least once a month. And I'd also like to know how that relates to any of the other factors or potential for success in other areas. Is there a relationship between that attendance and other parts of your programming?
Mm-hmm. Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, there may be a connection between attending religious services and lower rates of misconduct, although that might be a self-selection error. In other words, people who attend religious services might be less likely to engage in misconduct. It's hard to sort it out. On slide 11 and 12, you see the familiar pie charts that you've been looking at for the other divisions. It shows the relationship of the budget and the FTE for this division relative to the whole department, and then within the division, the relative functions by proportion of budget and FTE. Slide 13.
Before you go on, Ms. Martin, would all of, going back to the Senate Bill 267, report that you all gave us earlier, do all the dollars for programs that are intended to reduce recidivism come out of your program, or would some of them be in other places as well?
Chair Shields, all of the programs identified as needing to be compliant with Senate Bill 267 are in this division.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wessel.
On your pie charts, the information services is 40%. Can you flesh that out a little bit better? I mean, I understand that you've got to make sure when these folks are getting ready to be released and playing around that. It just seems high to me for some reason. You know, I know it's a big FTE position. I'm on slide 12. OISC. I'm assuming that's offender information.
Chair Shields, Senator Westland. I think the reason that looks kind of odd is that that's an area of the division or a function in which we actually employ most of the people who do the work.
Right.
So it's not just sentence computation, it's also offender records. So we have staff in every one of the institutions maintaining the records in a consistent way. Many of the activities of our division are contract. And so we don't have actual employees providing education, providing cognitive programs, or providing alcohol and drug treatment. So it looks disproportionate in terms of the FTE.
That was part of the question. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
The next slide on page 13 shows the budget history and the FTE through the last few biennia. You'll notice in 05-07 a jump in FTE without a corresponding jump in budget, and that's because when we brought over the former employees of Linn County and Douglas County Community Corrections, who are now state employees, it didn't cost any more money because that money previously went to the county. We keep it now and pay those staff because they're state employees. In the 07-09 budget, most of the increase comes from the increased population and the opening of Deer Ridge, 12.13 FTE, mostly in offender records and sentence computation and religious services, are related to that population growth and the opening of that institution. The other driver of new positions is the policy package that creates the reentry coordinators. Next topic are budget drivers, and obviously prison population increases are one of the major drivers of costs in this division. The Office of Economic Analysis forecasts that we will have a population of 14,180 by the end of this coming biennium. That impacts this division's budget in terms of the need for education and religious services and record staff, and also alcohol and drug treatment. So all of those pieces of our budget are impacted by the numbers of inmates as they grow over time. In addition to just sheer numbers, our division's also impacted by the numbers of those individuals who require interventions. So we have more people coming in, but we also look at how many of those people need what kinds of service. So the fact that majority of folks coming to prison need some kind of adult education or credential. Most of them have alcohol and drug problems. Most of them have some kind of antisocial thinking. That, in addition, drives the need for increases in the services that are part of this division. Another driver is prison intakes and releases. That driver impacts primarily our sentence computation staff because they need to pay attention to each person when he or she comes to prison, and then again when he or she is leaving, to make sure that the sentence computation is still correct, no new information has come in, and so on. Another budget driver, similar to prison population growth, is the growth in the community corrections population, and that impacts the baseline funding calculation for community corrections grants. Probation is expected to grow by nearly 4% next biennium, post-prison supervision by about 3%, and those serving a 12-month or less prison sentence by 5.8%. For this particular budget, the cost of qualified addictions treatment staff is also a budget driver. We have a budget policy package that would reset the rates that we pay our alcohol and drug treatment providers, which will allow them to pay their staff a rate which is more reflective of current market conditions. Our rates for our older programs were set in about 1990. They have only occasionally been increased by inflation. Some years these programs didn't get any inflationary increases at all, and we have simply not been able to fund them at a level that allows them to keep up with changing market conditions. That causes them to hire inexperienced or untrained staff. It also drives very high rates of turnover. In our largest program, the salaries currently being paid are about 25% below market, and that program, not surprisingly, struggles the most with staff retention and hiring of qualified staff. And finally,
sure. Thank you. Can you give me an example of a program and the type of staff were talking about this 25% under the market.
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, I'm thinking particularly of our program out at Powder River, which is our largest alcohol and drug program. That's the program with staff, average staff salaries. They're bringing in people 25% below what the agency that certifies alcohol and drug counselors in Oregon tells us is the average salary. And that means that they are bringing people in to work as counselors in the prison who have no previous experience with that kind of work. They've also experienced an over 90% turnover rate during at least a part of last year, so they've been really struggling to get and keep qualified staff.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Could you provide us some documentation that they have as a result? I mean, they tell us that. How do they tell us that? Is it a survey that they've done, or a market survey, or industry survey?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, we got the salary average information from the organization. Its acronym is ACBO, and I do not remember what that stands for, but it is, do you know? It's the certification board in Oregon that certifies alcohol and drug counselors. So we can go back to that source and provide that to you, of course.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned a very high turnover rate last year. Certain services managed by Children and Families, for example, we hear that consistency of treatment or consistency of a counselor or a caseworker makes a huge difference in outcome. Is there any statistical data that would indicate to us that is anything similar is true in addictions treatment, for example? If someone is seeing is working with one counselor and then they work with one or two or three more over the course of a few weeks, is there a difference in outcome?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, I feel certain that there is. I'm not certain that we can find some corroborating data. We do know from the corrections effectiveness research on programs that having staff that have a certain level of experience and a certain level of education, these factors are associated with the more effective programs. So to the extent that there's some corroboration, it tends to be, I think, more in that area than in the continuity of intervention with a single person. Let's see. Final driver that I wanted to mention today is the cost of community supervision staff, community treatment, and community-based punishments. The cost of supervision has risen faster than the state funding formula that was created in 1997, and so have the costs of contracted community treatment programs and sanctions. Today's actual costs were captured during a time and cost study conducted in partnership with the counties in 2006, and I will, when we get to that budget policy package, explain how we conducted that actual cost study. I would like to skip over the agency's key performance measures since those were reviewed in the overview and talk briefly about some of our internal performance measures, which begin on page 21. We're looking at a number of measures to help us know how well we are doing in preparing inmates for successful community living. And some of the data that we've begun collecting is the percentage of inmates with housing at release, the percentage of high and medium risk inmates who enter programs prioritized for them, that would be cognitive and alcohol and drug programs, and the percentage who need education and who complete an educational program while they're with us. We've just begun collecting that data and set a baseline, and now we're beginning to reflect that out. It helps us know if we're going in the right direction or the wrong direction, and it helps us know what kinds of questions to ask so that we can improve the outcomes in those particular areas. We also are looking at, as a further measure of the success of transition, we're looking at what's happening during the first 180 days after an inmate leaves prison. We're looking at how many of those are employed and how many of those are compliant with their supervision. And we just have baseline data on that now, so we don't don't know if we're going in the right direction or the wrong direction yet. Having a performance measure, nevertheless, helps us focus on those things that we believe are most connected to success, and gives us an idea of if what we're doing now is having the effect that we want. We also have a number of internal measures that are related to community corrections. That's on page 24. These objectives were identified in partnership with the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. We identified four major objectives for community corrections. Those are to reduce recidivism, to monitor the conditions of supervision, since community corrections is the agency given the responsibility of monitoring the conditions set on an offender by the court if they're on probation, or by the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision if they're on post-prison supervision. We're also charged with promoting offender change and addressing the victims of crime. And so we have a number of measures that we look at to tell us how well we're doing in that area. Wanted to spend a moment on recidivism as a way of measuring what we do, because it's complicated, and you hear lots of different opinions about what's the right measure of recidivism and how do we compare to other states and that kind of thing. Recidivism is helpful to us primarily because it tells us if we're going in the right direction or the wrong direction, or if a group that we, say, send to an intervention or a treatment program does any better than a group that is kind of the same and didn't go to that program. It doesn't tell us how many offenders are actually committing crimes, because most crimes are not detected. So it's not an absolute measure of how many crimes offenders are committing when they're on supervision or after they leave prison. The important thing is that the data be good data and it be comparable over time. And so that's how we have been using the recidivism data that we collect. And as you all know, we collect information on reconviction of a felony offense within 3 years of either starting probation or being released from prison. We have looked for some other states that might look at their recidivism in a similar way. Most states, as it turns out, use return to prison as their primary measure of recidivism. We could use that too. We'd always look good, but it wouldn't tell us very much. Most states allow folks to be revoked from parole supervision back to prison, and that drives their numbers. In Oregon, for the most part, if you are revoked from post-prison supervision, you stay locally and do your sanction time at the local level. So comparing our recidivism to states who are measuring themselves that way doesn't help us know very much. California is notorious for having very high rates of recidivism, but much of their recidivism is driven by these folks that are being returned to prison. If we look at resentenced to prison in California, about 27% of their population released from prison is resentenced to prison for a new crime within 3 years. That compares to Oregon rate of about 22.5%. So we're a little better than California, but it's not the wide disparity that you would see if you were just looking at percentages in the media. Minnesota.
Pardon, can
yeah.
I interrupt you? So the difference between the 28.9%, which are somewhere around there, which is the recidivism rate that you generally use, and the 22 is?
Chair Shields, the 22.5 represents that group that are returned to prison after they leave us, as opposed to that group that's reconvicted of a felony offense.
Okay.
So there are so many ways that one can look at recidivism. In order to compare ourselves, we have to make sure we're looking at the same thing at the same time. Minnesota does look at reconviction of a felony within 3 years, so very similar to our measure. The rate that they're reporting for fiscal year 2006 is 36%, so our rate in the last time we reported was 28.6. So we're really struggling to find states who look at recidivism in the same way that we do. We're still trying to get information from Georgia and Massachusetts. They may be reporting recidivism out in a similar way.
Representative Nichols.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have mentioned a phrase very carefully several times, reconviction within 3 years. Could you help me understand, given delays in the criminal justice system and in completing, you know, everything from booking to completing the court case, I assume that what you meant, reconviction within 3 years, is at the end of the trial and the determination of guilt. It is 3 years. But given when all this started, could you help me understand when, within 3 years, how many would be counted? Is our state comparable to other states? Do we process things through the criminal justice system at about the same rate? So are we counting the same number of people, or does it really all equal out over time? Because there's always the lag, and how many are left at the front end and how many are left at the back end?
Representative Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, I think that your question points out the difficulty of trying to compare our system with other people's system, because my thinking is that there are probably many differences in how each state processes criminal cases. I mean, our laws are also different. So a felony in one state might not be a felony in another state, and so on. So the getting good comparison that means something is a challenging kind of thing to do.
If I could ask one more on the recidivism. You talked about how in a cohort you extract some people out if they've already been reconvicted once in that time frame. So if you started with, say, 100 people in a cohort, how many would you take out due to that reconviction process? Do you have any sense of that?
Representative Chair Shields, I don't know. I know you can fail once in a cohort. So if you're in a release cohort, you can fail one time. So we're not double counting failure. You can also succeed only one time. But I don't know how many of the people who fail are reconvicted a second time, but I'm sure that that data is available.
Could you get that to Doug and pass that out? Thanks.
So we are looking at recidivism as a way of understanding if things are going in the right direction or the wrong direction in probation and also in post-prison supervision. We look at those separately, and we compare ourselves against the baseline that we set in right before the big change in community corrections. So we look at the data from 1996. Right now, we are about the same in terms of recidivism for probation and lower in terms of recidivism for post-prison from that particular baseline. We also look at positive case closure as a way of measuring how well we are getting people into compliance with the conditions that have been set for them. So you can see we report that out by probation and by parole post-prison. There's a move by the Bureau of Justice Statistics and the American Probation and Parole Association to use this data as the comparison data between states, because it tends to be more consistent and have less of the problems that many of you have understood around differences in the criminal justice processes in various states and the myriad of ways that states look at recidivism data. Our post-prison supervision success rate has been steadily improving over the last 10 years, from about 42% 10 years ago to about 63% today. We look at offenders engaged in treatment and employed. We look at collection of restitution, completion of community service work. These are all the measures that are included in the intergovernmental agreement with counties and that we've agreed to as a system are the things that help us know how we're doing and carrying out the major functions of community corrections. The next part in the presentation is a review of the budget policy packages, and I will save the community correction package to the end because I wanted to spend a little bit of time explaining how we did the actual cost study. So I'll go over our other ones first, and then we'll end with that more complicated one. So the first policy option package is the creation of transition and reentry coordinators to be placed in our reentry facilities. These individuals would be the ones responsible for conducting a transitional needs assessment and addressing some of the stability needs that we know offenders have when they leave prison. So the programming that we would be putting in place, and that doesn't exist now other than in one particular institution where we have the single one of these types of people working now. Employment readiness would be something that we would cover in the transition curricula. We would also We are providing the ready-to-rent certification so that when inmates are leaving prison, they have something to show a potential landlord that they know how to be a good renter. And we would help them know how to be successful on supervision, teach some problem-solving skills, and help them develop linkages to the community needs that they identify before they leave and to community support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ginger, where is that staff located now? You said there's one staff. Which institution?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, that's at OSCI.
Ms. Martin, if I could ask you.
Thank you.
Question. Actually, probably to Director Williams. In Veterans Affairs, you got a lot of compliments about the work that you do with returning veterans who are leaving the institution. About 15% of all inmates in DOC are vets, according to the Director of Veterans Affairs. Those services, are they paid? They come from the Department of Veterans Affairs or from your department in some of these staff positions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we certainly appreciate the compliment from the Veterans Department. We have worked. Ms. Martin and I actually spent quite a bit of time about a year ago starting to work with the department to try to get a greater degree of reach in at our institutions, particularly our transition institutions. The federal government offers veterans, regardless of whether they're incarcerated or not, depending on the kind of status they separated from the military with, a wide range of benefits, access to treatment and housing and other things that are federal benefits that wouldn't have to necessarily come out of community corrections-based money, local community, county investment money, or DOC money. And the sense was, both from our side and the veterans' side, that we were missing the opportunities to link offenders who had potential access to those benefits, to those programs. So we worked closely with them to sort of reintegrate this approach, to have the veterans folks actually come in who understand these programs and do reach in. It still operates to some degree on a limited basis, and because of turnover and changes both on their side and our side, it's one of those challenges to keep those relationships going on a consistent basis. This position for these transition reentry coordinators, that would be one of the kinds of things that would be made permanent in the nature of the responsibility and the relationship, would be scanning this, you know, these cohorts of releasing offenders, identifying the ones that were veterans, bringing the veterans people in to make the program announcements and all those things that need to happen. They're really the drivers of who can access these programs. We can make the inmates aware that the programs exist, but it takes somebody from veterans to actually figure out whether or not a person does or doesn't qualify. So it's exactly that kind of reach-in that we're hopeful that these transition coordinator positions would be able to facilitate. We're doing it right now based kind of on a relationship issue and the fact that we're pushing it from our level. But if Ms. Martin and I were to disappear 6 months from now and the Director of Veterans was to disappear, there's no guarantee that those relationships would continue to operate at the level they're at. And it's just an example of sort of that found opportunity to access resources that are out there and available if you just know about it.
Thank you very much. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of weeks ago, when we were hearing about some small bit of money that might be available for Department of Corrections, there was a question that I asked about what other funds might be available, and the answer at that time was pretty much nothing. But what we're hearing today is that there is the potential of access to other funds. When I think about investments that some organizations make in, for example, hiring a grant writer, because if you have someone to be searching for grant opportunities and who knows about making applications and can do a good job of making those applications, that it's an investment, basically, and the return on investment can be pretty high. What is the Department of Corrections investing in looking at and obtaining other funds?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, I came before you, I think, a week ago or so with our latest application for a transition grant, which would do something very similar in that single location to what we're proposing here. We have, we do keep an eye on the transition-related grants, and we've applied for a number of them over the years. So it is something that we think about. It fits our agency mission, which I think is an important criteria when applying for a grant. not sure if that's answering your question quite as completely as you wanted to.
If I could maybe fill in a blank, too. I think what Director Williams is suggesting is that bringing the county vets officers in, then get some resources for the offender once they get into the community, housing, et cetera. But you're not suggesting that they can get federal benefits while they're incarcerated.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathanson, no. This is all money that is available to veterans for the kinds of programs that exist when they get back into the community. But to the extent it offsets community corrections dollars at the local level, there's a benefit there. But it doesn't necessarily directly offset Department of Corrections institutional type operations.
This particular policy option package should impact our key performance measure on recidivism and also several of our internal performance measures, the percentage of those leaving prison with stable housing and those with employment at release. That is data that we collect now. Policy Option Package 113 is our sex offender pre-release program. The idea of this program is to provide pre-release preparation for the highest risk offenders that are 6 months from release. And we have proposed a 50-bed program unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary Minimum Facility. We intend to contract for that treatment service, consisting of about 40 to 50 hours per week of structured interaction. Currently, we have sex offenders housed at that location, and we are facilitating reach-in by their parole officers to make it at least easier for the parole officer who will be continuing to work with that individual to begin that relationship before the person leaves prison. We would anticipate that this package would impact recidivism, but because sex offenders as a group have a relatively low rate of recidivism, even impacting that in a great degree isn't going to impact our statewide key performance measure. And so for that reason, we would propose a new internal performance measure that would specifically look at community stability and compliance of these higher-risk sex offenders once they leave the program. So we would be looking at, are they following through with their treatment requirements? Are they registering as required? Are they reporting to their parole officer as required? And are they complying with all of the various requirements and conditions that have been placed on them?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Byrd.
On this lowest, sex offenders being among the lowest risk for recidivism, is that because they're not caught or because treatment works, or is it just in the nature of them? Because this goes counter to what a lot of us have thought about the intractability of the sex offender. Adult sex offender mentality.
Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, I don't think it's inconsistent with the understanding we have about the intractability of the problem. So while we aren't curing individuals of their propensity to commit sex crimes, we're helping them control that. While individuals are on supervision, they do tend to have fairly low rates of reoffense because they are prioritized generally for supervision and because the approach is very comprehensive. While a sex offender is under supervision, they are being supervised closely by their parole officer, they are being supervised closely by their treatment provider, and they are often also having other forms of monitoring like polygraphy and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of attention placed on these individuals while they're on supervision. There's some indication that the recidivism rate goes up a bit after all of that attention is over and they're off formal supervision. But during supervision, they do tend to reoffend at fairly low rates.
Senator Brown?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of follow-up. So if it's not the treatment that works but the high level of supervision, why should we spend a lot of money on treatment?
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, I'm so glad you asked me that because that was not the message I intended to give. We have, in preparing this package, we actually did a literature review of the existing research on sex offender treatment, and there's good evidence now that sex offender interventions in place, particularly cognitive ways of working with offenders, actually are effective. What I think is unique to the approach that happens during during supervision is that we've got a package of the treatment piece is essential and the supervision piece is essential. So it's a comprehensive management approach that seems to work best. And if you, you know, sort of look nationally at the national experts, they also confirm that it's this comprehensive approach that seems to work the best.
Okay. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, sorry for the sidebar here. One of the things that we did also want to point out, I think, with Policy Option Package 13 is this is a pre-release program, but this isn't per se a real treatment program. The nature of this program is to prepare these individuals for returning to the community as a sex offender, for both being ready for treatment for the cognitive that will be administered. This will have cognitive components to it, but it's really designed to prepare these individuals for release. And as we did this literature review and then work with the counties and the experts in sex offense around Oregon, there was a lot of discussion about how intensive of a treatment program ought to be done inside prison. The determination was that what was happening is often these sex offenders were releasing to the community. They were unprepared for supervision and not amenable initially to treatment upon release. And so the idea was to essentially create a staging program and to pilot this. You could tell that this is a fairly small program to determine its effectiveness, but to pilot the idea of staging sex offenders in this program for release to the community to determine whether or not that actually does a better job of both preparing them for that high intense level of supervision, helping them make sure that they actually follow through on their plans, and making them more amenable to the kind of treatment that they're going to get in the community. So we really did spend a lot of time developing this with the local providers who were doing the real work around sex offender treatment and with our county partners to try to come up with a program that we thought was the most effective. We currently offer no sex offender treatment inside the Oregon system, in the institutional system. This would be the first time in a number of years that we've had a consistent programmatic approach to addressing sex offenders before release, and it was the message that we were receiving loud and clear from our county partners about what they wanted us most to do to get this population ready for returning to the community. Was that helpful?
It was very helpful. Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. One more question maybe. How many people do we foresee in this package coming through, the numbers?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, the capacity is 50 beds, and we anticipate that individuals will come into the program in the last 6 months of their stay with us. So in the neighborhood of 100 per year would move through the program.
Thank you.
The next policy option package is the alcohol and drug provider compensation package that I mentioned earlier. This establishes a new and consistent statewide contract rate for our providers. It's a model used by other state agencies, and it will allow our treatment contract agencies to hire certified and qualified staff, which should improve the quality and the effectiveness of our in-prison addictions treatment programs. The increase will give us a consistent rate across all of our contractors of $34 per day. Right now, the average is about $23, and we don't have a consistent rate. You heard from Paul Bellici yesterday from Civigenics, our newest contractor. His program is receiving a rate much closer to the rate that we believe is the kind of most conservative but adequate rate that we can really get away with in terms of contracting with providers. And he mentioned to you that they've done very well in hiring qualified staff and in scoring very well on the corrections program checklist, which looks at how closely their program is being delivered to what the research says. This is what we would anticipate for all of our providers.
And if I could just use that as a moment to mention that on March 12th, we will have in our committee Dr. Ed Latessa, who created the corrections, what was the checklist?
The corrections program checklist, yes.
Checklist.
Mm-hmm. This particular budget policy package should improve our key performance measure on success during transitional leave, but we also would propose a new internal measure that would look at the recidivism rates for program participants compared to a matched group who need treatment but we weren't able to reach while they were in prison.
Mr. Chair, correct me if I'm wrong, Ginger, this package would bring the treatment part of a provider rate comparable to what DHS currently pays for residential treatment after you factor out the room and board cost, because corrections provides room and board costs correctly.
Comes with
$34 is close to what DHS pays for the programming part of residential treatment also.
So we are now to the Community Corrections actual cost study. And let me walk you through how we did that, and then I have with me today representatives from our three partner associations, the State Sheriffs, Oregon State Sheriffs Association, the Association of Oregon Counties, and the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, who would like to also say a few words about this package today. This policy package updates our case rates and funding formula for community corrections based on today's costs and should impact our key performance measure of reducing recidivism and all of our internal performance measures for community corrections that I shared with you earlier. The actual cost study was, the purpose of it was to determine the per offender cost for supervision services and sanctions. So we continue to think about community corrections case rates as being comprehensive case rates that include the whole package of community corrections activities that are necessary to manage these felony offenders when they're in the community. So the results of this study are then incorporated into new case rates that are more reflective of current costs. This project took us over a year to actually complete. It was very comprehensive. We pulled together an advisory group from the counties and from community corrections directors to look specifically at the community corrections part of our budget. And this work included Department of Corrections staff, employees from all 36 counties. Every single county had staff involved in this actual cost study. And we also worked with the state associations. There were two elements to this time study. One was a time study, and the other was a budget detail collection of information. The time study was used to determine how much time it took a probation and parole officer to work with different types of offenders and offenders at different risk levels. So we had literally hundreds of probation and parole officers tracking cases over a period of 60 days and writing down all of the time they spent managing that particular case. So we looked at new cases that were just coming onto supervision. That's a different workload than someone you've been managing for a while. We looked at the highest risk, the medium risk, the low risk, and the limited, which is our very lowest risk cases, each separately, and collected time information on all of those cases. We also collected budget information so that we could capture all of the costs of operating a field office. So we looked at not just the probation parole officer's salary, but all the associated costs, clerical help, supervision, management, desks, computers, paper, pens, phones, everything you can think of. We collected information so that we would understand both the direct and the indirect costs of providing community corrections supervision. And then we also collected information on all of the other things that are included in community corrections, correctional treatment programs, community-based sanction costs, and services, transition services, for example. The results, then, are an updated case rate for all of these types of cases that are managed in the community, the new cases and the four risk levels. And then we built this case rate on a foundation of officer time. So, let's see. So each case rate started with how many hours does it take an officer to work with this case in a month, and then we loaded all of the other costs into that hourly cost. We also weighted the new cases, high and medium risk cases, more heavily because evidence-based practices would indicate that we should be using most of our correctional interventions, our treatment programs, and our sanctions with the higher risk individuals. And most counties actually have made those kinds of choices over time. So I'll try and give you enough detail on this so you kind of figure out what we did without making your eyes glaze over, but I'm happy to answer any questions if I'm not giving you enough detail. Because we know how many offenders are in the community, and we know how much time it takes to manage each group, So each high-risk offender is 2 hours a month. When we know we have 10,000 high-risk offenders, so we know we have 20,000 workload hours. That's the kind of math we did for our whole population. So we figure out how many workload hours there are to manage the current 35,000 offenders in the field. And then we take all of the costs that it takes to deliver supervision, the pens, the pencils, the clerical, the manager, and the officer, and we divide that by the workload hours. That gives us an hourly cost for supervision. So a case that takes 3 hours to manage needs three times the resource of a case that takes 1 hour to manage. That's essentially how the case rate begins to sort itself out. We also did something similar with the services and sanctions costs, but we took, in this case, divided all of the services and sanctions costs only by the workload hours generated by the high and medium risk offenders and the new cases. So we apportioned those services and sanctions costs to the case rates for the high, medium, and new cases. Are you with me? More or less.
Don't let her break out spreadsheets.
So in the end, after all of this math and all of these workload numbers and dividing all of these budgets into that, we get new case rates, and then we can use those case rates and the corrections population forecast to figure out what the cost of supervision is over the next biennium. So when Sue Porter tells us there's going to be so many thousands of high-risk offenders over the course of the biennium, we can multiply that by the case rate and find out how much that is. There is one other piece of understanding how we do this, however, and that is that we eventually get to a capitated rate for two populations rather than looking at five populations. I've been talking to you about four risk categories and new risk cases, new cases. That's five different groups. We take that information and create a per-head cost for people who are on probation, and a second per-head cost, this is on slide 38, for people who are coming out of prison. And the reason the costs are different is because the populations are different in terms of their risk profile. So the group that comes out of prison tend to be more higher-risk individuals in that group as opposed to the group are sentenced to probation. And so the daily per-head costs are different because of that reason. So when Sue Porter does our corrections population forecast to allow us to use the capitated rate, she tells us how many band 1 probation people they're going to be in the next biennium and how many band 2 post-prison people. We use our capitated rate to build the state budget. We use our capitated rate to distribute the funds. Okay, that's, I think, as simple as I can make it. I'm happy to answer any other questions that you might have.
Perhaps the most important point is how many counties agreed to this at the end of the day?
Chair Shields, all counties participated. We have the agreement and support of this methodology of understanding our actual costs from all three statewide associations.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Max Williams, Director of the Department, you'll recall in the first day of presentation, back in my overview section, I had the two big bar graphs that reflected sort of the key increases in the Department of Corrections budget. About a 4.5% overall increase is tied directly to community corrections, and we walked through the four components of that. You remember part of that related to the forecast as it was catching up in this biennium, part of it related to the inflationary increase, part of it related to the future forecast, and then part of it related to the impact of adjusting the case rates based on the actual cost study that Ms. Martin just described. So this is a part of the overall increase, this actual cost study, but it's not the sole increase tied to the community corrections budget that's recommended in the governor's recommended budget. And I think it's important to remember that component, that there are forecast drivers at work as well beyond just the actual cost study. But the actual cost study really, in my opinion, members of the committee, having dealt with Senate Bill 1145 issues from my time in Memorial in this building, and some of you predate me, obviously, and were maybe even involved in the process, but this is, I think, the thing that we have been waiting to finally accomplish in order to try to bring the issues around Senate Bill 1145 and getting to a model that actually compensates counties operating community correction systems at an appropriate rate for the work that actually needs to be done. And it was a monumental task to do it, and I just want to put on the record in front of the committee, we appreciate the cooperation of our county partners, both the community corrections directors, the sheriffs, NAOC, in facilitating what was really a tremendous process to get to an answer that we've all been working a long time to truly understand.
Great. Thank you very much. Wilson.
Ginger, correct me if I'm wrong, you've just described the supervision portion. You left out sort of the other half, which was the jail cost component of community corrections. Want to add to that any or not? Sorry to ask you the loaded question.
Sarah Shields, Mr. Wilson. This, as Mr. Wilson noted, this particular process was used to determine the costs of community supervision and the associated activities. Jail costs have been a part of the community corrections funding formula since 1997. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association did conduct an actual cost study, revising the one they had done previously and upon which our current rates are built. But in the end, the association recommended to us that we use the prison per day costs, including the administrative costs, so the day-to-day costs of running the prison, the 60 whatever it is, $65 a day, and the additional costs of running central office as the building block to incorporate into our capitated rates. And we agree with them to do that. So that is the cost figure used to take into account the jail costs in our capitated rates.
I think I got that. So you decided that the number of people on supervision would be just as good a predictor as people in jail on a given day. So,
Chair Shields, no, we actually do look at how many individuals were sentenced to the 12-month or less sentence and used the prison rate. I'm trying to figure out how to say this without getting too complex. When we create our capitated rate, we're looking at the whole profile of the population on any given day. So if we're looking at, say, the probation population, a certain number of those or a certain percentage are serving a local control sentence for a new crime or a revocation. A certain percentage are being managed at a high-risk level, a certain percentage at a medium risk, and so on. So we have case rates for all of those risk categories that I described to you. The case rate for the local control in this particular scenario is actually our prison per day cost. So think of it as a case rate, and it's incorporated into the capitated rate.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add, I think one of the challenges that the sheriff's had is that depending on what county you're from, the costs associated with the jails, the size, the scope, and those kinds of issues are really all over the board. And I think what they determined was instead of trying, there was no way to really build a model that would individually fund each jail at their actual cost. So the idea was to come up with an acceptable rate that all the sheriffs could agree to. Some were higher than the state rate. There were some clearly that would be lower than the state rate. What they agreed to ultimately was to agree to essentially the rate that I'm funded by the legislature to incarcerate an individual, my daily operating rate for incarcerating an individual. And the theory was that if we used that same rate and applied it to community corrections, that was a reasonable standard. It would leave some counties in an okay position, other counties in a less okay position, but collectively they thought that was the easiest model to work from. And we have Sheriff Anderson in the room, who's probably better apt to discuss kind of the rationale behind that than I am.
Yeah, before we move on with more questions, we've got three presenters that will take about how much time?
Whatever you have left, Mr.
Chair. We've got 15 minutes. Is this an easy question, Senator Wesson?
Well, you almost put this into a medical terminology in terms of per capita or And so that's what I was getting at. I mean, you don't risk adjust the payments based on utilization of higher level. I mean, you blended the rate and functionally came up with a capitated system. I mean, that's the simple way
Chair Shields, Senator Wesson, I oftentimes think of our current rate as being very similar to a capitated rate in a managed healthcare setting. So you have some people that are very expensive to manage. You have other people that cost almost nothing to manage safely. And so, you know, you always hope you can manage with the dollars, the block grant you have, take care of the expensive ones and the cheap ones, and hope it all kind of works out.
One quick question, Representative Cameron. I'm following your formula here, and hearing the Department of Justice and how many hours an attorney can bill out, how many hours can a caseworker take on?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron. There have been lots and lots of time studies on probation, parole kinds of activities, and generally, the sort of generally accepted notion is about 120 hours of actual delivering of supervision of offenders in a month, in a week. No, in a month. That's when you take out the vacation and the meeting time and the sick leave and all the ancillary duties that are not directly associated with supervising an offender.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Martin. I'm going to use the prerogative of the chair and move us on to make sure that our guests can have their chance to testify. And if you could please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Todd Anderson, the sheriff of Tillamook County, and I'm representing a number of groups here today. Besides the Tillamook County Sheriff's Office, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association has asked me to speak for them. The Community Corrections Funding Committee, I also chaired, and worked directly with Department of Corrections on the number of issues, including the most recent funding formula. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association worked on jail cost study. They worked with the sheriffs that have community corrections directly under them with the actual cost survey and best practice for parole and probation officers. The sheriffs had worked and decided that the most recent formula that was developed was a fair and equitable settlement. This has been a ongoing situation where sheriffs have worked to be a partner and collaborative, a partner with the Department of Corrections in order to find a stable and fair formula. We work directly with Department of Corrections, and we had about 95% of all county jail beds throughout the state to determine what would be a fair formula. And as Director Williams stated, that some of those jails were significantly higher and some were lower. The overall state rate came out to about $103 average per day. We determined that the fairest way was to ask for what the state actually pays per day rate, including their administrative costs, and that this rate would be one that could be accepted not only by sheriffs but community corrections directors and commissioners throughout. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association voted, and a unanimous vote was concluded that we not only agreed with this, but that this would be something that would end what had been a 10-year working to find a formula that may allow us not to come back every 2 years and have to fight for what we believe was a fair rate for that. We believe that the community corrections directors and the sheriffs have developed the best possible way to reduce recidivism. You talked about a number of programs and best practices, including the sex offender treatment programs. I was a community corrections convert. I came from an enforcement background to the sheriff's office in Tillamook and took the jail over in 1997. At that time, my philosophy was take the key and throw it away, lock the individual up. But I quickly found out that that without giving the person, the offender, some type of treatment, some type of direction, that you were turning the person out on the street and basically turning the same product out on the street that had come into the jail. I was introduced to our community corrections director in 1997 and worked directly with him in sending individuals to treatment. And I saw success within the programs that where offenders who had been in the system as a juvenile came into the system as an adult and was in our corrections facility, had not had any type of treatment. Working directly with community corrections to get pre-treatment services for the offender, arrange inpatient treatment at the end of their sentence, and we have seen a reduction in the number of people coming back into our facility. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association supports Senate Bill 5505. We believe that this is a collaborative effort, and I think that it will stop a lot of the I think representation that the counties hadn't been funded fairly in this program in the past.
Next.
Chair Shields and members, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm Benton County Commissioner Jay Dixon, and I speak to you today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. By way of disclosure, I'm Vice Chair of the AOC Public Safety Committee, but I also serve on the Community Corrections Commission and the Oregon Corrections Enterprise Advisory Committee. You have my testimony in writing, so I'm going to try and just hit the highlights in the interest of time. And if you really are enthralled by what I have to say, you can read it all of it word for word. I want to make three points, I think. One is that I'm here both personally and on behalf of the other counties to support the governor's proposed community corrections budget. Others have talked about how we arrived at the numbers. This was a long, long process. Several years that I've been involved in it, and it started before I got here, involving the Department of Corrections, the Community Corrections Commission, the Governor's Office, the Association of Oregon Counties, the Community Corrections Directors, the Sheriff's Association, some legislators attended some of those meetings, and other people. So there was considerable dialogue and negotiation and compromise over a long period of time to get to where we are today. As Ginger has said, county community corrections programs oversee 35,000 felony offenders in the state of Oregon compared to about 13,000 who reside in prison. So a significant portion of these offenders are taken care of, or the public's being taken care of for these offenders by the community corrections program. And the counties contribute more than $122 million annually or biannually to community corrections in addition to what the state puts into the community corrections funding for these programs.
Mr. Dixon, yes. Those numbers, I just wanted to underline them a little bit. What's about the ratio of people being supervised?
35,000 being supervised within the 36 counties, 13,000, they may have a better number than I have, but in round numbers, 13,000 roughly in prison. So almost three times as many people are being supervised by the counties that are being supervised by the Department of Corrections. couple of other points. I used actually some, in terms of recidivism, and there was some conversation about that. I looked at the numbers prepared by the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, and I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they've done an outstanding job, I think. I mean, they're a nonpartisan organization directed by their legislature. They looked at a 13-year history, and in every category of felony crime, recidivism rates were lower for felons who had been sentenced to community corrections programs than those who had been imprisoned. And you have the numbers in what you have that I've written. Property crimes was 58% recidivism among those overseen by community corrections versus 78% for those incarcerated in prison. Violent felony recidivism was 52% among community corrections clients versus 64% in prison. And sex offenders overseen in the community had a recidivism rate of 27% compared to 42% for those in state prison. I have not tried to compare the Washington State numbers with the Oregon numbers with regard to recidivism. I don't know how those compare and what factors they use. But the point is that by whatever system they use, those in community corrections have fared much better in terms of recidivism than those in the prison. And what about cost? Well, you've heard about the cost already. It costs somewhere between $8 and $12 to supervise an offender in the community corrections program. And if you have to put somebody in jail or in prison, it's somewhere between $75 and $100+ per day. So it's certainly significantly less expensive to keep these people in community corrections programs than to turn them over to the state prison or the county jails. And I would remind you that nearly 95% of the individuals in state prison will ultimately be released back to the community where they need the services of community corrections folks. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well said.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the Joint Ways and Means Public Safety Committee. My name is Steve Berger. I'm Director of Klamath and Lake County Community Corrections. I'm also the president of the statewide Association for Community Corrections Directors, or OACCD. It's on their behalf that I'm here today to testify in support of the governor's proposed budget for community corrections. I want to thank you for the opportunity, and I also want to thank the invitation by the Department of Corrections. I recognize this is a hearing for a state agency, but I think the invitation by the Department of Corrections to the Sheriff's Association, AOC, and OACCD indicates the type of unique and successful relationship that we share as associations with the state and the counties. In my testimony today, I hope I can relay the success of the relationship in Senate Bill 1145, which is evidenced in many ways through successful and unique programs in the communities. I would like to highlight a little bit about the successful actual cost study and time study that we did with the Department of Corrections. This year-long project included 10 separate time studies capturing the actual costs of probation and parole officers, and also collected, as Ginger noted, the full budget detail of 36 counties capturing the indirect costs. This detail documents and supports the governor's proposed budget based upon the October population forecast. This cost study also accurately and more better reflects the costs the counties provide in providing supervision, services, and sanctions. This actual cost study model establishes a simple per-offender cost for supervision, sanctions, and services necessary to manage the offender population in the communities. Interestingly enough, although this budget is a $24 million increase over the previous baseline budget, it actually only equates to about a dollar per day difference for 9,000 offenders out of 35,000. The remaining 26,000 offenders are basically at the same case rate that we received in the 05-07 biennium. Community corrections, I would look at, as has been previously testified, is a cost-effective approach to community safety. At a case rate of $792 or $1,199 a day, the cost is at least 10 times less than the prisons, than the cost of incarcerating somebody within a prison. You add together the effectiveness of community corrections with the fact that over 70% of offenders are successful under supervision, we realize a significant cost avoidance. I use the phrase cost avoidance rather than savings, recognizing that we actually avoid costs rather than rather than a true savings when we are successful in preventing future crimes. The savings is realized through fewer offenders returning to prisons. The governor's proposed budget honors the state-county partnership established through Senate Bill 1145, and the spirit of this legislation establishing a commitment to full funding for counties to carry out their supervision in the community. Senate Bill 1145 created what is probably the most important aspect in Oregon Community Corrections, which is local control and the ability to use locally based solutions with offenders. The state-county partnership creates the ability for each county to provide programs unique to their jurisdiction, enhancing public safety based upon what works in their communities. Based upon proven strategies, Community Corrections enhances public safety through a balanced approach of supervision, service, and sanctions. Supervision is generally provided by the POs, services generally contracted to treatment providers in the community, and sanctions are obviously served in our local jails. Community Corrections is committed to the principles in Senate Bill 267, requiring programs with the primary purpose of reducing recidivism be evidence-based and cost-effective. The Community Corrections Commission identified the programs that would comply with Senate Bill 267, specifically, in general, alcohol and drug treatment, cognitive programs, domestic violence, sex offender, and employment programs and life skills. Statewide, under current reviews, Community Corrections programs funded documented 36% that comply with Senate Bill 267. That's ahead of the state legislative mandate of 25%. I actually believe that number is actually higher than the documented 36%. However, it's simply a fact that there's too many programs in the community, limited administrative resources to review each program on an annual basis. I would like to highlight and comment one aspect of the community of the Department of Corrections budget, noting the transition specialists. Community Corrections and the Department of Corrections are working closer than we ever have before on reentry and transition services. The Department of Corrections is currently partnering with Umatilla County and Klamath County on some reentry programs and encouraging counties to reach into the institutions working with those offenders that will be returning to their respective counties. One example of a successful program with early results is a program in Multnomah County where historically they previously experienced a 15 to 20% no-show rate following release from prison. A current study or a current review of 669 offenders revealed that after reentry services and participation in transition, only four failed to show. That documents approximately about less than half a percent of failure to show the over 99% success rate. As often is the case in life, showing up is half the issue, and with this population, it's increasingly important to work with the offenders when they present us with the opportunity for showing up for supervision and taking advantage of that referral process. In conclusion, I simply want to emphasize, if I can, the success that we are experiencing in the state-county partnership through 1145. The governor's proposed budget strengthens that relationship and honors the spirit of which better reflects actual costs the counties bear in providing the supervision, services, and sanctions. I also want to note, as what's been emphasized previously, the agreement that's here today by all 36 counties, the Sheriff's Association, AOC, and the Community Corrections Directors, and the State Department of Corrections, I believe exemplifies Senate Bill 1145 as an effective partnership between the state and counties. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Berger. We really appreciate you coming all this way, and we definitely appreciate what all of you do to protect the state. Colleagues, we are over time. If you would like to ask the guests questions, I'm sure they'd be happy to stick around afterwards. And so I'm going to adjourn this meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you.